Hare Krishna. So once I was discussing with Srila Guru Maharaj ideas for other books besides the ones that were published. And one of them, I said, like a small book to take the different sayings that he has, and because they're unique. And I'd take these little say it would be a small, like inspirational kind of book. And Guru Maharaj said, well, like what? And I said, well, like dive deep into reality, or you know, mercy is above justice, or because at first he was like what? And I started naming a few. Then he started naming more. I went, oh, so that would be a good one. But he said that he wanted a book, he didn't flesh out the title entirely, but he said called Inquiry the Absolute. He also said we should make an Acharya's Guide. Like after Sri Guru and his grace, he said, now make a book for the gurus. But Sri Guru and his grace kind of is that book also. But Inquiry the Absolute, Absolute Inquiry. Like in the second canto, Varyanesha te prajna, loka atma hitam nipa, something like that. Where Sukadeva is saying, this prajna, this question you're asking, Parikshit Maharaj saying, what is the duty of one in life specifically for one who is about to die? Because he had 7 days death notice. But Sukadeva says, actually, this question is beneficial for everyone. It's not just like, oh, let's listen in. This man, he has only 7 days to live. See what they tell him. Because we have so much time. We don't know how much time we have. That's the problem. At the end of Blade Runner, when the guy's leaving with the robot girl, his part-time nemesis, the police man, says, too bad, we don't know how long she's going to live. She has to die. Because they don't know how long these particular series of robots will live. And then he said, too bad, we don't know. You know, she's got to die. We don't know how long she has to live. He said, but neither does anyone else. And that was kind of the point. No one knows how much time they have. So he says, this question you're asking is not only beneficial for you, it's beneficial for everyone. Whether they have 7 minutes to live, 7 days, 7 years, 70 more years. And about base, I mean, if you had to put it in just money, it's like saying, what should you do with your life? Because we say, what is the duty of one who, you know, it starts leaving what we don't talk like that. Right? It basically saying, what should you do with your life? Whether you have 7 seconds, 7 minutes, 7 years, etc. And that's why he tells the story of this Maharaj Katvanga, whom helped the demigods. And when it was time to give him a boon for his help, they said, what do you want? Because usually they want the girl or long life. The one Greek guy who asked for eternal life forgot to ask to be young. That was a big oversight. But anyway, so they're like saying, what do you want? You know, this is what we usually give. You know, do you want the package that we usually give? Or what? He said, first of all, I like to know, how much more time do I have to live? And they said, glad you asked, like a few seconds. So Maharaj Katvanga, and we're told he used that time to focus. Right? One boy from the American Pacific, teacher from the American Pacific School for Atheists came here And he was asking some questions. He brought one of his friends, and so they're reading Gita, and he read this Gita Mahatmyam, where it says that, like, even if one is the worst type of human being, a murderer, he's a scoundrel, he did everything wrong, but if he, like, appreciates Bhagavad Gita, you know, before he dies, he gets everything. And he just said, I just can't accept that. Like, as if that's not fair. Someone else lived their whole life in the right way, but this guy, he did everything wrong. Then at the last minute, he has some connection with Bhagavad Gita. He's exonerated from everything. He gets everything. Yes, it's telling you, that's the power of Bhagavad Gita. That it can cancel a lifetime or lifetimes of wrongdoing. That's why it's the Gita Mahatmyam. It's telling you, here's how glorious is this book. Like we find in the Garga Samhita, how glorious is Tilak, right? The Gopi Chandan, that we're told, like, what was it? Again, the similar thing, you know, some devotee's putting on Tilak and like some spilled from his hand on the ground, and then he goes to do his Seva Puja. But then that abject, immoral, murderous, scoundrel person drops dead on that spot where the Tilak is, and then he gets liberated. So someone goes, that's not fair. Yeah, mercy is above justice. Another one of Guru Maharaj's sayings. So it's what you're supposed to take away from that is how powerful is the Lord's paraphernalia. We're told that his paraphernalia, this is very interesting, is non-different than him, actually. Right? It's not like, here's the Lord and there's his paraphernalia. His paraphernalia is inseparable from him. So much so, again, Garga Sangita, when Krishna expresses the desire, the interest to descend into this world with his Nitya Leela, his divine pastimes, which he does from time to time. We know innumerable avatars are coming, because people say, why do you have to wait so long? There are innumerable avatars. Why do they have to wait so long for us to get it? It's not like, why do we have to wait so long for them to come? They're coming time and time, and this way and that way, and every way, shape, and form imaginable to try and help us. But we're told, once in a day of Brahma, Sahasra Yuga Parjantam Ahor Yad Brahmano Vidu, 1,000 Yuga cycles, means 4,300,000,000 years. Once in a day, or times two, 8,600,000,000, whatever. It's a lot, a whole lot of years, right? That Krishna descends, right? So when he's making that decision, and as Guru said, when you're dealing with the infinite and Nitya Leela, it's same, same, but different. It's not an exact repeat. Oh, here's the part where I say this and then you say that. It's not like that. Right? It's similar. We're given similarities. Right? It plays out in a similar way, but with uniqueness at the same time. But at any rate, what Garga Sangita records and expresses, that Krishna is thinking to descend into this world. And Radharani says there that, and it's like she's the original woman of all things divinely womanly. And she said, I'm not going unless we take all of our stuff with us. Right? And what is their stuff? The Jamuna, the cows, the peacock, you know, the whole Vrindavan. And she repeats, she says twice. In other words, not a copy. I know you can do that. You can copy everything perfectly, and then we go with some sort of vaibhav extension of our paraphernalia. No, we must descend with all of this. And what, by your inconceivable power, remains, that can be the, what are the Russians called? Sputnik. Right. Yeah, Sputnik, right? That can be, but not, I want the original stuff with us. So there are different schools of thought about that there's Krishna Lila going on in the spiritual world and some extension comes here in the so-called Prapancha Lila, that means the material world, and is here for some time and then goes back. But there's another school of thought that says miraculously, amazingly, supremely, mercifully, that Krishna brings the original here, and what remains is the extension, or vaibhav. And there's evidence to support this by the statements of Srimati Radharani and Brahma Garga Sangita and elsewhere. And so you think about it, and that's why there's a certain, as you think, oh, the material world, that's just for these Nitya Buddha souls who don't seem to ever get it, and you have to again and again descend. You know, it's so boring trying to rescue these people. It's not like that. Right? Rather, and what makes this inconceivably wonderful is that Krishna's bringing, descending, Swayam Bhagavan Krishna with Srimati Radharani, not an expansion, not an extension, and with their inseparable eternal paraphernalia, and mixing with finite. Like, he's that merciful. He's going to bring, it's like, you know, we're going to try and give them exposure to the best, everything possible, and mix with the finite. The infinite is going to mix with the finite as though he's one of them. That's Krishna conception. So, why did I say that? Because of...
Srimati Radharani didn't want to come unless...
Yeah, but before that, way before that.
Garga Samhita and powerful paraphernalias.
No.
Maharaj Katvanga.
Yes, had a moment. Oh, and then I was telling about the power of things that happen in a moment. Right. But as powerful as those things may be, and they are, no doubt. In the Brahma Gita, Srimati Radharani says, Jadanu charita lila karna piyusha viprut. Sakrid dadvana viduta dvanda dharma vinashta sapari griha kutundam dinam utrija bahuva iha vihanga charjam bhikkhu charjam charanti. She talks about seemingly in a negative way. That's a way of, it's an indirect way of expressing a truth. So she's talking about the power of one drop of hearing about Krishna. If one drop, you know, from the hand of the person with the tilak has that effect, what is one drop of harikatha? Or karna piyush means, you know, ear nectar, nectar for the ear. Like Guru Maharaj said, Krishna karnamritam, he translates as Krishna nectar for the ear. Pravishta karna randrena swanam bhavam saroham dunoti shamalam Krishna shali yatasharat. It's in the so-called autumn chapter, or no, in the second chapter, it's in the Bhagavatam. That's safe to say. That Krishna conception is carried through the ear. Like, it's a canal, it's a channel, and it goes to the heart, right? It's through sound that you reach the heart. So Krishna conception enters through the ear and then touches the heart, the core consciousness. So she's saying, as if she's lamenting, right? But it's a divine lament. Even lamentation reaches its perfection and draws remuneration in Krishna conception. Like if you lament that you're not Krishna conscious, that's a way to become Krishna conscious, if it's genuine. So she says, Yadanucharita lila karna piyusha viprut. Piyush means nectar. Sakrida danda viduta danda dharma vinashta. She's saying, your life is ruined. That's what she's saying. One drop of hearing about Krishna, your life is ruined. You're finished. So I think, wait, this is the greatest devotee of Krishna? Is this the best advertisement she can come up with for why you should get connected? What does Rupa Goswami say in a similar way? If you want to remain attached to your family, your, you know, everything that's near and dear to you, don't go to see Govinda in his threefold bending form and standing on the banks of the Jima. Don't go and see that. It'll ruin everything for you. Then you think, well, what is that? I'm the kind of person, that's when I go and look. So she's saying, one drop of this and it just ruins, your life is ruined. Wait, what is your life? You mean your karmic destiny, your karmic circumstance, this never-ending cycle of being born and dying and repeatedly doing again and again and again, suffering endlessly in the material world and forgetfulness of Krishna? She's saying, yeah, one drop of hearing from about Krishna puts an end to that. That's what she's saying. But more than that. Right. And she's just talking about the effects of karna piyush, means a drop of nectar in your ear. It's like, doot, they put that. And Guru Maharaj, and I wonder like how he knew this, but he said that he compared to the criminals who, and we see at least in the old time movies, like they're trying to open a safe and there's the way where you listen and, you know, and that takes forever. That we know. Right? But then there's this other way where they pull out this special liquid and they like put a drop on and it goes, it goes all the way through, and then they open it up. So what she's saying in essence, a drop of hearing about Krishna, what does it do? All that vault that's around the heart, the vice-like grip that lust has upon the heart, bidyate hridaya granti chidyante sarvasangshaya, it's this. A drop of this substance pierces all of that and then goes in and touches the heart. And once the heart is touched by Krishna conception, it can never forget that. Even if it tries, if that person tries to forget Krishna and absorb themselves in mundane life again, this will come again and they'll have some remembrance. That's why Narada, when he's speaking to Vyas, says, speaking of moments, he said, better, similar to what's in the Gita, the proposition is put forward, well, what if you put all this time into cultivating Krishna consciousness? And either you don't achieve perfection, or after some time you desist and you spin off doing something else. What about that? And Narada's answer is really wonderful, where he's saying, whatever you get during that time far exceeds lifetimes of any other kind of culture. So even if you only come in connection with it briefly, that's it's still better. Even if you come and then you go, it's still better. He's saying, and add to that, that the remembrance of that will haunt you. Whether it's through lifetime after life, it will come back and draw you once again in the direction of the holy lotus feet of Krishna. So, Saru Sangha, Saru Sangha, Sarva Shastra Khoi, Lovas Matra Saru Sangha, Sarva Siddhi Hoi. It says Lava Matra. That means like a moment, means like a nanosecond. Saying that association with a genuine saint can give you everything. Whereas endless study of the scriptures, performing good works, doing this, that, the other thing will not deliver this. But a moment's association with someone who has it can has heart, actually, feeling, genuine feeling of Krishna consciousness. I remember in Srila Gurudev's final days that sometimes I would say the first line of some slokas, just because he likes hearing them and it sends his mind and heart in a particular direction. And he'd be happy. Some days he'd just wave it off like, you know, not in the mood or just bad timing or whatever. But I would just take the risk. And most of the time he went with it. But there's one particular sloka that Mahaprabhu chants, and it's perhaps from Karanamritam. And I've always found it very difficult to commit this sloka to memory. And I think I understand why. But when I would start with the first line of it, which I could say in a rote recitation, style, right? You memorize something and you recite it. When Gurudev would recite this, he would undergo some sort of transformation. He was visibly moved. It really touched him. He really felt something when he expressed it. That's the difference. Feeling. Right? The heart will not be satisfied with any amount of knowledge. Right? The heart is not seeking knowledge. The intellect seeks knowledge. And when you apply the intellect to divinity, most often they end up in the doubt world and become faithless. Just like, because Brahma, no less than Brahma, says, Jnane Prayasam Udapasana Manteva. Stop trying to measure him with your mental and intellectual prowess. It's a question of faith, what he wants to reveal to you. And Guru Maharaj will say, what you were telling about him to the public, he'll go out of his way to prove you wrong, because he's a dynamic infinite. But I remember when I had a few moments with His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, and Prabhupada at one point was asking me, like, what service was I doing? I remember at that time, Prabhupada was looking for a new servant. Thank God he didn't pick me. And I think he saw right away, it's not him. But he's going, you know, like asking me what I do, and I work at ISKCON Press, and I ship books, and I also try to do some preaching with my partner. We preach to Indians, members of the Indian community in New York. And Prabhupada was like interested in that, and at one point I said to him, I said, but Prabhupada, sometimes when I'm preaching to them, they'll say, oh, I know what is Krishna. Like, you know, you don't have to tell me about this. I know what is Krishna. And then I remember he's eating at the time, I'm trying to serve him. And he flipped his head back and he said, that is their disease. That's how he said it. That is their disease. What is their disease? That they think they know Krishna. They know God. They know the infinite. They know divinity. He called it a disease. Brahma says, Janantu eva janantu, kim bahukta name prabho. Others may have so much to say on this subject, I don't have much to say myself. Although, that's within the prayers of Brahma, which if you study them, all the tenets of Vaishnavism are there. So he's kind of in his prayers saying, I don't have much to say, but here's 45, 50 verses, you know, that you might consider. But we understand what he means. He's saying, I made a fool out of myself by trying to measure him, to measure the infinite. Blake, in one of his drawings, has a person whose name I believe is You Reason, and it shows him underwater. He looks like the Christian God, like from Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel. He has that look, the long beard, and I don't know if it's supposed to be him or not, just, you know, they look, they could be twins. But he's underwater and with a compass, an old-fashioned compass, which means the two thing like that on a map. He's like trying to measure the universe. Right? So, and his name is You Reason. So Brahma says, give up trying to measure him. I tried to measure him and was made to be a fool. It's announced in the beginning of the Bhagavatam. Tene Brahma Hridaya Adike Adikavaye. It's a heart-to-heart transaction. And what? Muhyanti Yatsuraya. Even the suras, that means the gods, will be bewildered in trying to understand Krishna conception. So like any good book, in the first sentence, they tell you everything and what to expect. So it says, even gods will be bewildered. Gee, will there be any examples of that? Oh, Brahma Vimohan, Indra Mohan, the Govardhan Lila, Brahma, you know, even Mohini Murti and Shiva. Right. So Brahma, Shiva, Indra will all be bewildered by Krishna in this book. And trying to estimate him. Shiva's case is unique, but Indra and Brahma is another thing. Shiva was just enchanted. Brahma and Indra tried to measure him, who is a Prakrita. They were deceived by his human-like pastimes, and that's the point to be underscored. Right. Any stereotypical, conventional notion we have about God will be left at the door if we're trying to enter the zone of Krishna conception. Right. So, Blake. What I wanted to say, what we need to this say before that is there's a system for knowing things, right? What's generally called Vedic talk, pratyaksha, paroksha, aparoksha, adhoksaja, a prakrita. That's why I said that. That's why I wanted to talk about that. The human pastime, human-like pastimes of Krishna. Right. Why the ultimate pastimes of God are human-like, in fact, providing the template for human civilization. So, pratyaksha means individual sense experience. Like, this word aksha means eye or seeing. So pratyaksha means what you see, right, what you're capable of seeing. Right? And we know what the limitations of that are. Right? in very simple ways and very profound ways. And simple ways, you go, did you see that? You know, like, no, what? So then immediately you're reliant upon another person to tell you something. That's paroksha. Pratyaksha means what you see or experience individually. Jiva Goswami points out there are four defects inherent in human beings that disqualify us from understanding clearly, purely, factually, divinity. Brahm, Pramad, Viparlipsha, Karna, Patava. Tendency to be illusioned. What else? Sensory inefficient, imperfect senses, cheating tendency, Viparlipsha, and what else? We make commit mistakes. To err is human. I remember when I was a child in the car going to Key West in Florida, the Florida Keys. There was a sunset, and you could see this gigantic sun outside the window, you know, on the horizon. And our car was moving. I was probably like 3 or 4. But I kept wondering, like, no matter how fast we go or how far we go, it's still there. I thought that was really peculiar. Because I thought, it should be there. We go in the car and then it's like over there. But we keep going and it's still in the same place. So I was no genius, which is obvious from this story. But I did think it was kind of strange. And also, it didn't seem like we could get any nearer to it, no matter how fast we went or how long we went. Although it was this huge orange-reddish ball, I thought, like, if we turned the car, we could go there and get a better look. But it seemed, no matter what we did, it just remained that size until suddenly it vanished, which was also bewildering. So, with that type of observation, you know, observational skills, and then one can immediately understand the limitations of individual sense perception. So what it leads us to do is paroksha, the second level, means para aksha. Para means others, aksha, what they've seen. Right? So there's a very common way of that, like shared human experience, right? We do this all the time. You go online, like for migraines, I see what other migraine sufferers are saying about migraines, right? It's a way. It doesn't mean that it never delivers anything. It gives you a certain amount of knowledge, a perspective, right? So, but then there's what we call collective human wisdom. Like those who lived before us who've dealt with the same questions we're dealing with or the same problems we're dealing with, mainly, which is what? Mortality, right? Like the famous atheist, Christopher Hitchens, when he was dying of cancer, he got to write like one last book, and he's a humorist, also a wit, and he said, why is it whenever someone gets cancer, they're always described as, you know, like, you know, they go, Bob's a real fighter. He's going to fight this thing, you know, and he's going to win, you know. If Ladbrokes is taking any bets, I'll bet on cancer every time, and I'll win most of the time, right? So whether you're a fighter or, you know, like, it has nothing to do with that, right? It's going to gradually spread its influence. He said, it's as if to say, and when the person finally dies, he said, it's as if to say, after a long struggle with mortality, he succumbed. It's like saying, you know, he's going to fight mortality. He's not going to take that lying down. But he's going to end up lying down in a coffin because mortality is going to win that duel. So, and so many lines, so many verses, Are there Gurudev's Gray's Elegy? What I like, though, is also Thomas Nash, Litany in a Time of Plague. Beauty is but a flower, wrinkles will devour. Brightness falls from the air, queens have died, both young and fair. The line I don't usually quote, because that's bleak enough, but that follows that it says, what did it say? I must die, I must die, Lord have mercy, I must die. It was Litany in the Time of Plague, when they had a plague in England, and everybody was dropping dead left and right. So he's saying, beauty is but a flower, wrinkles will devour. Right? Even the most beautiful women in the world, of cinema, of photography, or whatever, inevitably they, wrinkle cream doesn't quite cut it, They, what happens? So beauty is but a flower, wrinkles will devour. Like the flower, we get these beautiful lotus flowers here, and they're beautiful for like 3 or 4 hours, and then it starts to vanish. And what does the poet say? Kamala dala jala jivana talamala. Right? At first, when I heard that, for years I thought he's talking about lotus petals. And I went, lotus, until I understood he's talking about, here's the lotus, but there's a leaf beneath the lotus. And if you look at the water on those leaves, you'll notice when you first see them, they look like mirrors almost. Like, it's amazing. It's a mirror. But like while you're watching it, without any hint or indication, it just suddenly rolls off. That's what he's talking about. He's not talking about the thing where you go, I can see, look what's going to happen. This is going to, it happened. Like someone got cancer and they're in this stage and that stage, they're going to, like that. He's saying, no. Kamala dala jana jiva natalama. What is it like? It's like the water on the lotus leaf. It's there 1 second, you're looking, and suddenly, without warning, without indication, it rolls off. And that's back to the original thing. He's saying, nobody knows how much time they have. Some people may be less than others. It may be clear. You get older, you can say, statistically speaking, you have less time. But anyway, so on that part, paroksha, taking advice from others. Right? We say, those who have lived before us, and they dealt with these questions. Right? Like Shakespeare, he dealt with the question. Right, his saying, to be or not to be, that is the question, right? I think it's to believe or not to believe, that is the question. But you can do many variations on that. But what I prefer in this context where he says, out, brief candle, life's but a walking shadow, a poor player who struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard from no more. It is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. That's his take on life. That's pretty good, actually. But anyway, so paroksha, those human wisdom, collective human wisdom, like some, they'll go, well, the Stoics used to believe, and then we like hear that. Or they'll, you quote some Greek poet from, way back, right? So, and our friend Richard Rorty, the world's former leading pragmatist, I say former because he's dead, would say, well, we should concern ourselves with whose opinions matter, right? And he's saying, and come on, whether the gods and goddesses, you don't know. I don't know if they exist or not. Like, well, are we supposed to live our lives according to what pleases Zeus? Because that's their conception of the gods, right? So he's saying, so let's just shelve that for a while. And you got an opinion. I got an opinion. You have feelings. I have feelings. Let's get together. And we're the people who matter. and work something out that's, you know, mutually equitable. It's hard to argue with pragmatism as a way to organize a weekend, you know, or have a party or something like that. He's saying life in existence. But what he does very cleverly is he's eliminated the gods and goddesses. Why is he saying? Because what they say is unverifiably true. Right? We don't know about that, but we do know about each other. But then he takes it a step further by saying that, you know, some people are not good at expressing themselves. Right? We're saying collective, but what about the people who can't express themselves? There's some people in the world, they're not writers or talkers or whatever. They live quiet lives, simple lives, but they have feelings, opinions about things. So who best expresses their opinions? Writers, right? So these great writers, through great writers, and we mentioned Shakespeare, through Shakespeare we've come to know so many human characters, right? So we're broadening our palette in that way of representation. Right? So then, but then when it comes to writers, what we find out, if we ratchet it up a little bit more, is the saying that, art is a lie that tells the truth. If you want to tell the truth, write fiction. So the best writers, arguably, write fiction, which is not literally true. So we could say, just to make a point, they're telling us lies or fabrications that contain truth within them. Right. So whether Romeo and Juliet are actually a boy and a girl from a particular family is irrelevant to the story. We can accept that. But this is all well and good until we say, but wait a minute, you said the reason we had to toss out the gods and goddesses was because what they say is not verifiably true, but we end up taking shelter of writers and the imagination of human beings who are, through their fabricated tales, delivering us some kind of truth. So what if we prefer to hear the stories of the Puranas and other alleged revealed truth and what is expressed there, even if it's not verifiably true, but it contains within it something that resonates within us as true? But that's another point. So you have pratyaksha, paroksha, collective human wisdom. And that brings us to Google. Right? So Google, they understand this. Right? But there's some other things they understand and believe that they may not want everyone to know and believe. And that is with regard to artificial intelligence. So, for example, they would say, we're going to make the sum total of human knowledge. We get this paroksha thing big time. We're going to make the sum total of human knowledge available to you. One of our programs is we're scanning every book in the world and making it available to you. You go, well, that, thank you. And there will be some ads or something to pay for this, but otherwise it's free. Well, thank you, noble Google people, for doing that. But here's where they're not telling you the full picture, is that you can't read every book in the world, right? If every book in the world at this moment is made available to you, how many of them can you read? Even if you literally started reading them now, nonstop, all day and night, you cannot do that, right? So having all the quantity of human knowledge available to you doesn't actually deal with the problem at hand, because it's how to interpret this that is most important. But what they left out is there something that can read all of the books of the world? And there is, and that thing would be called, euphemistically, a robot. So a robot could technically read all of these books that you cannot. So what they're getting at is, if this is the way that we achieve quality of understanding and wisdom, is that maybe the robot's in a better position to make decisions than you are, because you only read 100 books and the robot read 100 million books. Something like that, right? So it's taking this paroksha example to the extreme, that and revealing its ultimate absurdity, that quantity versus quality. As Guru Maharaj says, quality gives us relief from mathematics. In this sense, mathematics means quantity. So quantitative, it doesn't say in the Bhagavatam, tene brahma hrida means, and then the data was transferred into the heart of Brahma. And then Brahma transferred the data into the heart of Narada. That's not what it says. Tene brahma hrida means, heart is all is not about knowledge. Heart is about feeling. Anandam is about feeling, right? Krishna consciousness is ultimately about heart and about feeling, not about knowledge or data transfer. Initiation is not data transfer, where the guru transfers the data to the disciple. Right? Heart to heart doesn't mean that. How do you transfer heart? A sentiment, that's another thing altogether. We're told through service, not through intellectualism, intellectual prowess, but through serving tendency, the willingness to sacrifice oneself in service to guru. Recently we had the disappearance day of Sripad Bhakti Premik Siddhanti Maharaj, our senior beloved godbrother. And we saw in him that he was, although Gurudev gave him the name Siddhanti, in one sense that would have been the last name we expected him to give him, because that was not his forte, so to speak, right? But what he was known for were things like, in the blazing hot sun of Govardhan, where the temperature, if you're outdoors, could kill you, to give Gurudev some relief, he'd be on the roof of his room, pouring buckets of water to cool the tiles so that Gurudev underneath would get some relief. Understand? He's taking all this suffering upon himself so that he can give that much, a little bit of relief. He's taking a tremendous amount of suffering to give a little bit of relief to Srila Govinda Maharaj. Right? Like the Lalita Astakam, Radha Mukunda Parasam Bhavagarma Bindu Nirmanchano Pakarani Krita Deho Laksham Utunga Sahuram Vishesha Pashat Pagalvam Devim Gunai Silalitam Lalitam Namami. And she says, the greatest eagerness for the greatest magnitude of ignorance for the least seva. But here, he's willing to sacrifice himself to the extreme that Srila Govinda Maharaj can get a little bit of relief. Right? That's Guru Bhakti. And so many other ways it can be told. But ultimately, proof appeared when I remember very distinctly being on the veranda of Srila Govinda Maharaj in his final days in Calcutta. And we're both looking at this book, The Religion of the Heart. And he said to me with this incredulous look on his face, he said, Maharaj, how did he do this? You know, like he couldn't believe it, almost. And I said, ultimately, when you were delivering higher substance, he could recognize that. He could recognize it, identify it, he extracted that, and he presented it here. So he personified the very title of the book, which is what? Religion of the Heart. Right? So in many other ways, he may have, it may have been questionable. But what was undeniable is this transfer, this heart transfer of what was in the heart of Srila Govinda Maharaj, which is Krishna Bhakti, Krishna Prem, transferred into the heart of someone he named Bhakti Premik, which means heart, Prem heart, Prem heart. Bhakti Premik, Siddhanti. He did get the Siddhanta. Siddhanta is not intellectual. Siddhanta is about heart, actually. Right? It's not some separate thing that intellectuals get lost in. Krishna is Siddhanta. Siddhanta is Krishna. Siddhanta is heart. Without heart, it's just intellectualism. Right? Parroting. Sukadeva is known for tasting, the parrot who tastes, not the parrot who mimics. That's not why he's told as parrot. For tasting, we heard when we went to India that if you'd see these mangoes, the ones that had parrot beak, they were sweeter. And some scientists go, well, because the skin was broken, and you know, take your science and just, you know, please. Like Guru said, they spoiled the moon, these scientists. And that moon that was the subject of poetry and the love. And he said, what is called when the newlyweds go? Someone said, honeymoon. You know, like, yes, and that, and all these things. They said, it's just dust, right? It's just dust and rocks, nothing there. But when we look at the sky, see the moon, it inspires one with feelings of romance, mysticism, so many things. The moon, the beautiful moon, the enchanting, romantic, beautiful moon. He said, these scientists have spoiled this. Go away, you scientists. Leave us with our imagination. Right? So anyway, Siddhanti Maharaj, he personified Guru Bhakti, devotion to Guru. And I remember there's a section in the seventh canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And there's this big list of things that you realize, like, I'm never going to achieve this in 1,000 lifetimes. So that's a particular reading that you might not feel totally encouraged. If you read it deeper, I'm sure you'll be totally inspired. But you may just see this and go like, oh my God, you know, never going to happen. But at the very end, it says, but etat sarvam guru bhaktya purusho hyanjaso jayet. If you have devotion to Guru, you can conquer everything and achieve everything. He personified that. So through his devotion, the Guru Maharaj said, a kanishta adhikari, the third class devotee, can bypass the second class position and achieve the first class position through service to a Mahabhagavata. So, along those lines, we're appreciating him. We're back on the theme of paroksha. So we left with the Google folks, right? Quality brings us relief from mathematics. So there's another school called aparoksha, which means, so that each one has aksha, seeing, pratyaksha, paroksha, individual seeing, collective wisdom, then aparoksha, free from seeing anything, tabula rasa. Just like we used to see in school, it's one thing if the what's being calculated is a little off, but when it's so far off, the teacher would take the eraser and go, that's tabula rasa. Eraser, erasure, rasa. This is rasa in another meaning. Eraser. Erase everything and start up. So what they're saying is, yes, your perception is polluted by all life, sanskar, lifetime after lifetime of karmic circumstance and misconception. How are you supposed to know which way to go, who you are, what you are, all of these things? So what you need, tabula rasa, a clean slate, right? They compare it to like a deep sleep, and a deep sleep, free from all experience, then you can appreciate the spiritual substance. It's half true. But the Vaishnavas come and say, Ramanuja, no, but there's a world beyond Adha Aksaja, Adhoksaja, where you're right about that sense, acquired prejudice, acquired tendency, Adha Aksaja. It comes down, and when it comes down and reveals itself to you, all of your mundane sense experience is suppressed. That's the plane, Adhoksaja. And to invoke Blake again, Blake says in one of his famous sayings, you know, when the doors of perception are cleansed, we will see everything as it is, infinite. Right? And then people leave it at that. And they think, wow, that's really profound. That's wonderful. And it is. Right? But why should we stop there? If he's saying, when the doors of perception, what are they? The eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, right? The five senses are the doors of perception. When they are cleansed of what? Acquired prejudice, acquired tendency. Then they will see everything as it is, infinite. But what's left unsaid is, that means there's an infinite that can be seen, that can be heard, tasted, touched, smelled, felt. Add that all together and it means personality. It means the personality of the infinite. Krishna is the not only the personality of the infinite, the supreme personality of the infinite, who can be seen, heard, tasted, touched, smelled, etc. So we hear along similar lines from Rupa Goswami, Sarvapadi Vinir Muktam Tat Paratena Nirmalam Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam Bhaktir Uchite. Okay. Sarva Upadi, when all of these substitutes for Krishna have been given up, substitute persons, substitute places for the Vaikuntha world, etc. When all these substitutes, when you're no longer substituting, right, then you'll see the infinite as he is, Rishikesh, and what does the name imply? He's the epitome of sense experience, the ultimate thing to be seen, heard, tasted, touched, smelled, felt, all of those things. And what is inferred is that because he is Rishikesh and you have senses, it's not like, oh, well, thank God you can use these senses, you know, to do something good. No, this is what they're meant for, that you use your senses in service to Rishikesh, the so-called master lord of the senses. It's a perfect arrangement. Then we find out actually that's what the senses are for. Right? So the eyes are for seeing Krishna. It's just not, you know, an option. Like, well, you can see Krishna or you can watch a movie. You know, which is true. But what it means, ultimately, what are these eyes for? They're not for seeing the flickering, you know, the charming, what is he saying? The charming, Bhaktivinoda in his song? The dazzling bottles charm their eyes, etc. He's talking about the dazzle of Maya. Huh? No, he says bottles, actually. But anyway, this whole, and thank God, Guru Maharaj says, what does he say about Maya? It's almost non-existent. Right. Well, thanks for telling me. You know, like, he said, it's almost non-existent. From his point of view, like, there's Swarup Shakti, there's all of that, and like, Maya, it almost doesn't even exist. And he's like, wow, we must really be off, because we really think it does. You know? But he's saying, no, Maya almost doesn't even exist. It's just a part of Swarup Shakti that appears to, like he once said, a part of the perfect appears to be imperfect. That's what we're dealing with. But anyway, just to complete the cycle, so pratyaksha, paroksha, aparoksha, adhoksaja, what descends, not what you, by your own prowess, you get stronger and better and you're going up and up like a the Protestant ethic or something. No, he descends, he consents to reveal himself to you. How? Through humble acts of devotion, right? Krishna is not impressed with any level of knowledge or power accumulation, but with devotion, the infinite can make himself known to the finite. How sweet is that? Sri Krishna Karshini Chasa, Rupa Goswami says, this is one of the characteristics of pure devotion, is Krishna not only consents, because that sounds like saying, he's like, okay, you know, you deserve a little something. Here, whoa, you know, Virat Rupa. No, that's not for the devotees, right? But actually, he's irresistibly drawn to the devotee, in a sense, cannot but reveal himself to them, cannot conceal himself from their loving eye. And we know that's a very high stage, but also from the beginning, showing something to the sincere heart, touching the sincere heart, that karna piyusha viprut, through the ear, hearing something about Krishna and appreciating that. And then the heart is touched, and it's repeatedly touched until it's engulfed in Krishna's loving embrace. And all these superficial things that appeared to have a stranglehold upon the heart vanish. As the Bhagavatam says, Vidyate Hridaya Granti Chidyante Sarva Sangshaya Chiyante Sarva Shikarmani Driste Maya Driste Akhilatmani. And then at last, above that, Vaikuntha Guru Maharaj describes as the southern hemisphere of the spiritual world. The last one, notice, it does not have the word Aksha in it. It's called Aprakrita. And what does Aprakrita mean? Think about it. There are so many words you could use to indicate divine, but they were not selected. But the word selected is Aprakrita, and Prakrita means mundane. Aprakrita means not mundane or like the mundane. That's why Muhyanti Yatsuraya, that's why Brahma was bewildered, Indra was bewildered. This is God. This boy, this five-year-old boy, he's the ultimate reality? Come on. And I have some familiarity with Vishnu, you know, I run the universe, kind of, you know what I'm talking about. Later he's saying, I don't have much to say on this subject, after he was brought to his knees, humbled, humiliated. Right? Same with Indra. Right? But that's their leela. That's why we say Brahma Vimohan Leela, the Indra Mohan Leela. They're showing, they're playing that part. So don't get carried away with intellectualism, trying to analyze Krishna. You'll always come up two fingers too short, right? Dwi Angali, like Yashoda, when she's trying to bind Krishna by her own power. At least this is what's being shown in the pastime. By her own prowess, she's trying to bind the infinite. And she's always two fingers too short. But when Krishna sees the sweat coming down her face, the flowers falling from her hair, her intense focus, and realizes she's doing this to protect me. Not because she's mean or out of neglect, but what is her motive? Right? Anya abhilashita shunyam jnana karmaja navratam anukul yena Krishna. What is she doing? What is Krishna anushilanam to her? What is, she wants to protect Krishna. That's why she wants to bind him, so that he won't get in trouble, he won't get hurt. And then when he realizes she possesses that as a jnana shunya bhakta, that type of heart and devotion, it melts the heart of Krishna. and then he's bound by her. So he's bound by love and affection, not by her individual prowess or anyone else's individual prowess, but always by love and affection, thereby proving, as stated in the beginning, it's a heart-to-heart transaction. So if you come in connection with someone who actually has love and affection for Krishna, the best thing you can do is serve them. Offer yourself in service to them. It's interesting. We're told different, you should associate, seek out this, do that. But what if you meet a Mahabhagavata, means a lover of Krishna, someone who loves Krishna, has that. What should you do? It says, offer yourself in service to them. And as we were saying, Siddhanta Maharaj, he goes, when he met Prabhupada, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Prabhupada, and he said, he looked like he could use some help. It's like, oh my God. Like everyone else goes, I saw this mystic personality, you know, like I have my own way of when I first saw Prabhupada, you know. But he goes like, he looked like he could use some help. I mean, like, my God, how pure-hearted is that? And he goes, and I had a car, and I said, like, you know, I can drive you around. And Prabhupada said, yes. It was that simple. Prabhupada needed to go somewhere. He had a car. So he'd, like, drive Prabhupada around, you know, to Stowe Lake. Prabhupada liked to go on a walk on this particular lake in Golden Gate Park. He'd drive him there. Prabhupada needs to go shopping. Siddhanta Maharaj at the wheel. It's that simple. He got this, like driving Prabhupada around in a car. And you're going like, the yogi should meditate upon the, you know, and then looking in the eastern direction, you know, like he, the yogi should get behind the wheel and drive Prabhupada to Stowe Lake. That's what he should do. And make sure that there's gas in the car. The yogi should concentrate on whether it's on the meter is reading E or F. You know. Yogi should also have a driver's license. You know. So in these wonderful ways, the transaction took, and you see, then Prabhupada, he has so much love and affection that it's transferred to the disciple. He cannot conceal it from them. It's not a question of stealing it from them or for anything like that. Like the flow of the mother cow for the calf. When you bring the calf, the milk bag starts to flow, to like leak almost. And that's when the cowmen, and they let the little calf suck the udder for a while to get it going. And once it's going, there's a flow. So out of the, and the same comparison is being given of Arjuna and Krishna in Gita. Gopala Dugda Nandana, where it says, the Gita, what is that? That's like the cow and Krishna's, the milk, Arjuna's the calf, you know. These things are there continuously. They're not just nice metaphors, they're very real. And there are certain people who personify them in our lifetime, and so it was our good fortune to have the association of Sri Pad Bhakti Premik Siddhanta Maharaj. And the last thing I want to say is, when I remember being in Petersburg with him, you might have been there, and it was like on Janmashtami. And it was now, like we did the thing in the temple room and everything, and this is like extracurricular sankirtan. And it's around 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, and I hear this. And like, I look outside my window, and remember, Siddhanta Maharaj is very tall, and he specialized in the Udanda Nritya, means jumping up and down, like a danda. Right, and he's jumping up very high and coming down again, and he's playing these kartals like this, and he's going like, Haribo, Haribo. And there's around 60 young Russian boys and girls surrounding him, going, Haribo, Haribo. And he's just like doing that for an hour. <You know? laughs> And I was going like, my God, you know. And like, he didn't seem to tire or become exhausted from doing it, but like, he just keeps doing that, jumping up in the air and coming down again. And he looked very bright and he folds in, and all the young boys and girls surrounding him, like giving him even more energy to continue with that Nam Sankirtan. So, and I heard from day one when I joined in San Francisco that Prabhupada said, Chidananda's a pure devotee. You know, this is one of the first things I heard within a day or two of joining, that there was a devotee from our San Francisco temple who wasn't here right now. He was sick down in Santa Cruz, recuperating. But Prabhupada said he was a pure devotee. And we witnessed his pure devotion in many different ways and forms over the years throughout. So I think he left the world just before Srila Govinda Maharaj because he would have been unable to tolerate Srila Govinda Maharaj's Tirobhav. So he left a little early, and maybe to get things ready for Gurudev. Because I had this vision of like, he's there, Gurudev is there, and then Vaishnava Maharaj, Shrutasvara Prabhu comes, and he like knocks on the door, and the window, and then Siddhanti Maharaj says, Gurudev is sleeping. And then, and then it just starts all over again. Hare Krishna. So, fit for the Aprakrita Leela of Krishna, the human-like pastimes of Krishna, where all these fine, sweet interactions are there. Hare Krishna.